I'd like to call the meeting of the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is March 30th. And I believe we have quorum now. Representative Barrett, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes of March 29th?
Madam Chair, yes, I have. And these meeting minutes are outstanding, and I would love to approve them.
Okay. Representative Barrett moves the minutes for March 29th. All in favor, say aye.
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 Thank you. Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. All right. The first bill on our agenda today, we have Chair Nornis at the testifier stand. Chair Nornis, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. House File 3275. Not sure the correct... I need some guidance on the correct motion to make.
Chair Nornis, I believe your bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill.
House File 3275 then will be laid over. But
okay, Chair
Members, Nornis. I'll make this as quick as possible. We have a long agenda today. This deals with the Child Care Grant Program. The program provides financial assistance to resident post-secondary students to reduce the cost of child care. It's administered by the Office of Higher Education. It's only open to undergraduate students without a baccalaureate degree who have not completed 8 full-time semesters. This bill, 3275, would permit graduate students to participate in the Child Grant Program as well, providing that they've been enrolled for fewer than 8 semesters in a graduate or professional degree program. So that's all it does. It just allows that the grant program to be extended to those graduate students.
Thank you, Chair Nornis. Do you have any testifiers today?
I don't know. Do we have one? Okay. Come on down. Yeah. There is, as I understand it, there is money available to fund this, and they're not sure of the amount of money or how many will be taking advantage of this program. So if you're wondering about finance, that's not an issue right now. So,
okay.
Yeah. Welcome.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Hi, I'm Anya Dimitrenko. I am a first-year medical student at the University of Minnesota. My daughter Maya is actually here. She's 4 months old. And my pregnancy was unexpected, and I got pregnant about a year ago. And my support system fell through around August, which is when I started medical school. And that is when I reached out to the financial aid office at the University of Minnesota and asked for what resources might be available. And that is when I was told that there aren't many, and really the assumption is that anybody who pursues a graduate degree would have two parents caring for the child, and that was me starting out, but that was no longer my case. So I switched to taking classes half-time, so I'm effectively paying for to babysit my daughter, which is okay some days, but not really where my mind is professionally. I will be finishing medical school probably in 5 years instead of 4. And last week I took out an additional loan for sort of surprise childcare expenses and for any kind of babysitting. And the interest rate on that is quite steep. And I guess I don't know what else to add, because it's been really challenging, and it was really surprising to me to find out how little is available for graduate students and the assumptions that are made about women, especially and single parents in higher education.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have any member questions? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned you have your beautiful 4-month-old baby here, but I don't see you.
He's sleeping in
her
car
seat. Oh, she's sleeping over there. Okay. That's the only question I had. We always just, you know, it's all about the children in this committee.
Traditionally,
usually when they're older, but
the committee requires them to be passed around.
Passed around and cuddled.
She would be happy about that.
Yeah.
But cover yourself. She still sleeping. Spits up.
Representative Pawlowski can babysit.
Thank you, Representative McDonald.
Seniority, and I know who's going to babysit.
Very good. Are there any other members of the community that are the audience that would like to testify for or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none.
Wait, thank you.
Any other member questions? Okay, seeing none. Chair Norton, would like to renew your motion?
Yes, I just want to say that this bill was brought to me by students. That's how we learn. I guess maybe we're aware of it before, but it had to be sometimes highlighted or reminded, and it seemed like a good thing to do. So I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 3275 to be laid over for positive inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, so House File 3275, laid over for possible inclusion. Turn on us to your second bill, House File 2815.
Okay, again, make the motion that House File 2815 be laid over for possible inclusion. It requires the Office of Higher Education to gather information about the dual credit acceptance policies of each public and private college and university here in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and North Dakota. So it's information gathering only, and I assume we have a testifier or two or not. We found one. Here we go.
Very good. Welcome to the committee.
Welcome. You brought a briefcase full of testimony.
Oh, it's just no.
Welcome to the.
Oh, okay. All right.
Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Hello, Chair. Vice Chair. My name is Malik Bush. I am the co-director of the Center for School Change. My colleague, Joe Nathan, and I are here to briefly testify on House File 2815. I'm a lifelong Minnesotan. Took a brief stint away to go to college. And taught both at the K-12 and higher education levels and also worked in business. I'm here to urge the legislature to provide more high-quality consumer information to families and students about dual high school and college credit acceptance policies. The information we're suggesting here is not available in any single place. However, it is needed by students and families all over the state, not to mention their counselors, mentors, and advisors. This is basic consumer information. Specifically, we recommend that the Minnesota Office of Higher Education be asked to gather and share information about the dual credit acceptance policies of Minnesota, Wisconsin, and North Dakota public and private colleges and universities. In our presentations across the state, on radio stations, at college fairs, and in more informal sessions, this is one of the key questions we get as we talk about dual credit with students and parents. And we've disseminated this information in the past, and I've got a handout that I can give to you that people ask all the time. Well, you know, how will these credits be accepted once I get to college? So we know about the value of dual credit. We can talk more about that if you want. I can answer questions. But overall, students who take various forms of dual credit are twice as likely to graduate from high school. They're twice as likely to enter and graduate from some form of 1, 2, or 4-year program in colleges or universities. And the benefits are especially great for students from low-income families and communities of color. However, institutional acceptance of these students' hard work vary widely. We have a one-page handout on this. I can hand that out as well. Based on the information from 10 Minnesota public and private 2- and 4-year institutions, I'd like to highlight a couple of few major areas of difference that are significant. One, how much dual credit will be accepted. This is one of the things that students and families are really interested in knowing more about. The amount of dual credit that can transfer varies widely. At public 4-year institutions such as the University of Minnesota or Minnesota State, a student can transfer up to 2 full years of dual credit. And students are literally earning an AA degree sometimes before they graduate from high school. However, at certain other colleges, say St. Olaf or McAllister, they can transfer less than 1 year of that dual credit work, although those students have done sometimes a lot more than that amount of work. acceptance of CLEP courses for college level examination program. For $80, a student can take an exam. That the examinations are offered by the College Board, the same people who do the SAT tests. And a student can go in, take this test. You don't have to pre-qualify or anything. You just show up, take the exam. You offer the results of that exam for credit. It's a great deal for kids. Unfortunately, not all universities accept those credits. So again, it's the kind of thing that students and parents would want to know before they take that time, make that effort, whatever it happens to be. But it's a great way to save money. So for them to know up front would be awesome. Specifically, you look at students, say, for instance, who are native Spanish speakers. It's a wonderful way for them to earn enormous amounts of credit at very little expense because they tend to do really well on these exams. The other thing we run into is IB, International Baccalaureate. A lot of students don't know that the schools that they are at are offering standard level International Baccalaureate classes. However, most of the universities only accept the higher level credits, so they have to take a different class than the typical class that's being offered in their school. And then lastly, how are their CIS, college in the schools, or concurrent enrollment classes and credits handled? Some will accept them, some won't accept them at all. It really depends. This is all information that students need to know really as early as possible. We've been at events where there are students in the fifth grade asking questions about how do I prepare for junior high school, and they need to know this kind of information really up on the front end. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you for your testimony. I think we have a member question. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we're not really, this bill passed last year, doing a lot of what you just advocated for. This year, we're simply adding that the office shall gather information, but I think there's a mistype on 1.15. I think the office shall gather and share information with students and parents about dual credit policies of each of those institutions. You don't want to be gathering information from students and parents. It wouldn't be accurate probably anyway, because we don't always even understand what, you know, each of our state's laws are. So I think that's supposed to be a with, not a from. And so I just would ask if I'm misreading that, but it looks to me like I would offer an oral amendment if the committee would accept it to change that word from to with, or I guess that would be the correct motion.
Thank you, Representative Norton. Let's just go to non-partisan staff and just to have them confirm what you were just suspecting. Thanks.
Madam Chair, Representative Norton, it looks like, so the proposed amendment would be line 1.15, delete from and insert with. And I guess the effect of that amendment would be that instead of directing the office to, as Representative Norton suggested, collect information from individual students and parents about dual credit acceptance policies that they've received from other states, they would actually have to reach out to the colleges and universities themselves. So if that's the policy preference of the committee, I think that makes sense.
Okay, and Chair, do you have any comments, Chair?
No, I think that sounds like, I mean, you really read well. Most of us skip over a few words now and then, but that's good that you caught that. So I think you can act on that amendment. And
so consider a friendly amendment. So Representative Norton, would you like to that motion forward?
I would just move that we strike on line 1.15, we strike the word from and insert the word with.
Okay. All in favor of Representative Norton's motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. Amendment's adopted. And Chair Norton, do you have any other testifiers?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay, do we have any other member questions at this time? Okay, do we have any members of the audience that would like to testify for or voice concerns with the bill? Okay, seeing none, would you like to renew your motion or do you have any final thoughts?
The only thing, I'm not sure if I mentioned this when I first started presenting the bill, but the information gathered will be available on the website of the Office of Higher Education, so it will be easily available, and that's always something you wonder about. Gather information and how do you find it? So this will be in a nice, convenient location. So with that, I move that House File 2815 be held over for possible inclusion.
Okay, as amended. So Chair Nornes renews his motion that House Bill 2815 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Okay. And Representative Erdahl, if you want to make your way up. Welcome back to the committee, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Let's see. I guess I'll move the bill. I'll make a motion to move House File 3103 to be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Erdahl, do you have any amendments to your bill?
No, I do not.
Okay. You want to go ahead and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, always good to be before the Higher Education Committee again. You heard a similar bill to this last year, and we're back again. College Possible is a nonprofit organization that works to encourage low-income students to be admitted to and succeed in college. The 2015 Omnibus Higher Education Bill appropriated $250,000 to the Office of Higher Education in fiscal years 2016 and 2017 for immediate transfer to College Possible. The bill required College Possible to use the funds to support programs of college admission and college graduation for low-income students through an intensive curriculum of coaching and support at both the high school and post-secondary level. This program makes College Possible for low-income students. The program involves curriculum intensive support provided by AmeriCorps members, and this occurs during the high school students' junior and senior years. The support continues as the students attend college at our institutions throughout Minnesota. AmeriCorps members teach after-school classes with students enrolled in the program. As juniors, students learn about college application process, preparation for ACT, SAT, learn about college life, and the importance of college. As seniors, they are taken through the college application process, the financial aid process, scholarships, and learn about the transition to college. While in college, the College Possible students are supported all the way through college graduation, including everything from study skills to choosing a major to understanding college credits. With previous support from the state, College Possible has expanded throughout Minnesota and would use additional funding for further expansion. 99% of the students in the program earn admission to college. The program is currently in 50 high schools and 20 schools are on the waiting list. College partners in the program include Augsburg, Century College, St. John's, St. Fans, Mankato State, St. Catharines, St. Cloud State, St. Paul College, and the University of Minnesota. Our hope is to make this excellent program available to many more students throughout Minnesota.
You have a testifier?
Yes, I thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay. I have a testifier, and also if a page would hand this out, please. I have some materials to be handed out if I could get somebody to help. Okay. Thank you. Yes, I have Sarah Juke with me to testify.
Welcome. How do you pronounce your last name?
Juk.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Juk. I'm the Executive Director of College Possible Minnesota, and I'm here to testify in support of House File 3103. As Representative Erdahl mentioned, College Possible is a nonprofit organization that's focused on supporting low-income students to and through college. We work with students, we recruit them in the spring of their sophomore year and start our intensive after-school program with them as high school juniors. We support them as they earn admission to college and secure the scholarships and financial aid necessary to go to college. We support them in their transition to college, and then we coach them all the way through their college graduation. The students in our program, the annual household income is $25,000. More than 90% are students of color, and more than 90% are first-generation college students. The results of our organization and our students are unmatched. 99% of our seniors each year earn admission to college, and our students are 10 times more likely to graduate college than their low-income peers.
We have strong partnerships with our high school partners, with all three college systems within the state, and with many nonprofit organizations and individual colleges and universities in order to ensure the success of our students. We are an extremely data-driven organization, and we spend a lot of focus on evaluation to make sure that the work that we are doing with students is the best that it can be. We are now the only college access and success program in the nation that has positive findings on a randomized control trial, which is considered the gold standard of evaluation for an organization. We are so grateful for the funding that we have received in the past, and the funding from the state of Minnesota has truly fueled our growth throughout the state. 2 years ago, we were able to grow our college programming into Greater Minnesota so that we were able to put college coaches physically on campuses throughout the state. In 1 year, on the Minnesota State University campus, Minnesota State University Mankato, we saw a 100% increase in the persistence of college possible students when we were able to put a coach on that campus working directly with our low-income students. In this past year, we've been able to leverage the state funding to grow our program to high schools throughout the state. We added 30 additional high school partners to our program this year. So for the first time, we have students everywhere from Owatonna to International Falls to St. Cloud and to many, many schools right here in the Twin Cities. We are excited about the opportunity that exists with additional school partners and more students across the state. And so that's why we ask that you support additional funding for our organization so that we can continue that great work and continue to create more college graduates and a future workforce for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, I'm curious about this. Sounds like a really good program. I'm wondering if you could just share, what are like maybe the two or three top activities, not the right word, but I can't think of a better one. What are the three benefits or solutions or areas of help that you provide a student? You probably said that, and I probably just didn't hear it, but I'm just curious what you know, for someone who needs your help, what three things do you provide that really helps them get into college and then graduate?
Ms. Gould.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, our coaches are working with a group of students, so we're really building a cohort of students so that they can find support from their peers. They almost form a family with the group of peers that they have that will support them through the journey. But then the coaches are working with students one-on-one to really help them and meet them where they're at and help them navigate the admissions system and process and to navigate the college journey. And so often what our coaches are doing are not recreating any of the great services that already exist on college campuses, but helping our low-income students find those great services and connect with those great services and mentor students in the process. And so it's really about helping them navigate a college campus, build a network of support, every year making sure that every student is renewing their FAFSA so that they can secure the financial aid necessary to go, and really helping them navigate the system as a mentor and as a role model that is with them every step of the way.
Thank you. Representative Uwakum.
Thank you, Chair Nornes, and I apologize for being late. I think it's that kind of day for everybody. I co-authored the bill because I can only speak from the program that I've seen and at the high school level and what it's done for St. Louis Park High Schools. They just got their four-year results of what they've been doing to narrow the achievement gap and getting all kids ready to go on to higher ed if possible. And their scores came back where there's only a differential of 3% between students of color and students that are Caucasian across all the different categories. 3% gap, that's it. And that was a reduction from the teens and 20s they were seeing 4 years ago. And they mentioned four programs that they thought really allowed them to narrow that gap, and one of them was College Possible. They did an absolutely incredible job getting kids, coaching kids through the process, getting them into higher ed, and really not letting them, like, getting them out the door and going, okay, now you're on your own when you get to college. So So it really bridges that gap. It's an, really, I can't say enough about what an incredible program it is.
Bill, do you have another testifier?
I don't believe so.
Is anyone in the audience wishing to offer some testimony? Come on down. Welcome to the table. Can you state your name and then proceed with your testimony?
Yep. So my name is Chris Fleming. Currently a master's student in public policy at St. Thomas and currently an educator at Patrick Henry High School in North Minneapolis. So I'm going to try to make this brief and make this very concise. But just so you know, there's a lot of emotion behind this this testimony, as I was also afraid to come up to this mic. So I am here to not support H-File 3103, and my support doesn't come from my non-support doesn't come from the results. I was a former College Possible coach back in 2012. My results, my support, my non-support comes from kind of the diversity of teaching staff or coaches that College Possible has. Currently, I have only seen one black male who has been in this position at Patrick Henry High School, and that black male was me. And that was 4 or 5 years ago. And Patrick Henry High School has a population of black males about 36% to 40%. It's really important to me that as we talk about giving more money to College Possible, which has done great results and which haven't been one of those coaches who have put forward great results, that we also talk about College Possible being intentional about hiring teachers or hiring coaches who are diversified, that they're going into our Minneapolis public schools or any school with a diverse population. So I think as we talk about giving money to College Possible and we talk about increasing it, that we really put an amendment to this bill and make sure that College Possible have an intentional initiative towards hiring diverse teachers and diverse coaches. And I haven't seen that yet in College Possible over the 5 years that I have, over the 1 year that I was with College Possible, over the 5 years I have worked in a school that had College Possible. So I think for that reason alone is why I do not support increasing funds for College Possible. But I do like two reasons whether this committee either do some amendment to put in this bill that they have to have an initiative towards increasing diversity, or this committee really thinks about decreasing the fund until College Possible make a hard, fat initiative to increase diversity within their higher coaching staff. That is all. And any questions, I'm glad to answer. But this is really something passionate.
All right. Members? Anyone else in the audience just to add anything to the bill? Thank you for coming down. It's not as scary as it looks.
Right.
Representative Erdahl.
Yes, we'll have a little response to that first, please.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I can just take a moment to respond to that with just a couple of statements about our focus on the diversity of our team, because indeed we are working with a very diverse population of students, and so to have a team that reflects the students that we serve is extremely important to us. And over the years we have continued to focus our efforts on recruiting diverse members and leadership team for our organization. We look at diversity not only as looking for people of color to join our organization, but we look for people that have been low-income students themselves or were first-generation college students. And approximately 50% of our team would fit within one of those three areas. 30 to 40% of our team are people of color. We have been very intentional in the last couple of years about increasing our recruitment efforts around diversity and looking for more people of color to join our team. We have built a community access and inclusion group internally to focus our efforts to better support people of color on our team. We have created an incentive for people that are serving with us. As coaches, they receive a living allowance for the year, and we've actually added an additional incentive for people of color to serve with us by providing an additional grant or support for them. And we have also increased our recruitment efforts focused on historically black colleges and universities, other multicultural clubs and groups across the state in order to build a more diverse team to better support students.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, and I appreciate that response. I don't happen to have a quick oral amendment to offer right now. Last one was much easier. But I guess my question to you would be, the gentleman brought up a very good point, which is, you know, a lot of the students in our high schools and our colleges that are failing and struggling are black males. And so to that end, I think it would be a worthy effort, and it sounds like you're making one, but would you object to or perhaps work with Representative Erdahl on an amendment, as this bill will end up in, you know, if it moves ahead, it will end up in an omnibus bill or on the floor. Would you consider setting yourself some goals, perhaps, in an amendment moving ahead? As I looked at the bill, you do already have quite a few guidelines that you're following, you know, rural and urban and that sort of thing. I think this would be a very reasonable request, even though you're doing some internally, that you put some goals in writing. Would you be willing to do that moving ahead?
Representative Erdahl, or
I certainly would be open to that. And just may say that as a member also of the Education Innovation Committee, either this week or last week, that we had testimony on the racial disparity between groups in Minnesota. And so it's not, you know, just something that may be faced by College Possible, and they are trying to address that. But this is a what is viewed as a problem across our education system in Minnesota, that we do have a disparity between the most black children are taught by whites. That the fact is we do not have large numbers of black teachers in the state of Minnesota, and so that's a whole different area that needs to be addressed, and I don't believe that we're going to be able to do it here today, but this is something that education certainly is aware of and needs to work on.
Sorry, that's obnoxious.
Was that something I said?
No, it wasn't. Thank you, Representative Erdahl. You know, all the points that you're making here are true, and it is a struggle, and I think for that very reason we have an opportunity here to start working on the problem. And as you've said, you know, K-12 has issues. I carried a Teachers of Color bill my freshman year here. It was just a pilot, and it hasn't, you know, since then it kind of disappeared. And I know some others are working on that now, but I think this is one opportunity where we can take that step. So I guess thank you for your interest, and I know you've been a long time K-12 member and supporter, and so I'm just going to kind of put it in your hands, but strongly encourage the two of you to talk and see if you can't find some goals if this bill moves ahead. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Now, Representative Erdahl?
I think I'm done.
Okay.
Thank you.
Then House File 3103 will be held over for possible conclusion. All right, thank you. And Representative Fenton next. Chair moves that House File 3165 will be held over for possible inclusion at the end of the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, House File 3165 is very similar to a bill that I carried in this committee last session, only this one is a little bit different. This bill is much broader and makes a competitive grant open to a wide variety of alternative and non-conventional teacher prep programs from across the country to right here in Minnesota. One of the purposes of this bill is to not only address the teacher shortage being experienced, as I've heard in some of these other presentations here, but also the need for teachers of diversity. There is a growing statewide bipartisan concern around increasing our teacher diversity and educator quality.
The grant funding would be open to any alternative or experimental program that is selective, explicitly focused on increasing educator diversity and preparing candidates for hard-to-staff positions based on methods that are proven to benefit students. Through the state funding for MNSCU and the University of Minnesota, we already invest in traditional teacher preparation programs, but setting aside direct appropriation for competitive grant for alternative or experimental programs demonstrates our commitment to taking new and different approaches to preparing our educators. So by establishing a competitive grant program for the alternative teacher preparation programs, House File 3165 would do two key things. It would empower existing teacher preparation institutions in Minnesota to create new experimental programs that are built on proven methods to increase educator quality and diversity. And it would help establish new alternative programs that are explicitly focused on and experienced in increasing teacher quality and diversity. So next week you'll hear about some up-and-coming programs currently in practice. New programs such as the Grow Your Own will come through. But with that, I would like to bring my testifier up to talk more about House File 3165.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name, please.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Daniel Sellers. I'm Executive Director of MNCAN, a statewide education nonprofit advocating for the success of every Minnesota student from pre-K through college and career. Teachers are critical to the success of our students. In fact, both research and common sense tell us they are the number one in-school determinant of student success. With mounting teacher shortages, especially among educators of color in greater Minnesota and in certain licensure areas, we must pursue an urgent and multi-pronged approach to recruiting, training, and retaining the educators our students need. In fact, the new federal education bill, the Every Student Succeeds Act, or ESSA, identifies the importance of alternative preparation programs, residency models, and other non-conventional pathways to teaching. It's imperative that we create new avenues to the classroom right here in Minnesota. In order to encourage the creation and success of these new high-quality pathways, we must be willing to invest in them. Teacher quality and diversity are important enough that we must recognize it will take an initial investment to realize big returns. In 2011, the legislature passed a law allowing the creation of alternative teacher preparation programs, but now it's time to put that law to work. Unfortunately, barriers exist for many alternative prep programs, especially in the program approval process, but this bill would make funds available for programs to add capacity to overcome these hurdles. Yes, we have Teach for America in Minnesota, but while Teach for America is one important pathway, we need many more high-quality, diverse pathways that this legislation would support, including things such as Grow Your Own models, the Relay Graduate School of Education, which has campuses across the country and has a mission to develop all students for academic skills, a program called Urban Teachers, which is in Washington, D.C., Baltimore, and Dallas. These programs and many other have a track record of producing high-quality, diverse candidates. As the demographics of our students change, the programs that prepare our teachers must change too. We should work to attract these and other programs to Minnesota. Many of these programs have demonstrated a positive impact on student achievement, and the teachers coming through these programs are committed to elevating the teacher profession. Perhaps most exciting is that this bill would be available to many different types of programs, national programs looking to expand in Minnesota, current Minnesota programs seeking to expand their impact or grow to greater Minnesota, or brand new programs launched right here. And it's a competitive grant, so only the most impactful programs get funded. More educational bang for the taxpayer buck. Funding alternative or experimental pathways to teacher licensure will help Minnesota alleviate teacher shortages and increase educator diversity. I hope that you'll support Representative Fenton's House File 3165.
Thank you. Questions? Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to either Representative Fenton or Mr. Sellers?
Yes.
I'm just wondering, who are the grant applicants here? Who do you see as the folks that would be applying for these grant dollars?
Sure. So the bill lays out that it would be available to any teacher prep program seeking approval under the alternative preparation law, which is 122A.245, or any teacher preparation program seeking experimental approval from the Board of Teaching. And many times the programs seeking experimental approval are actually current Minnesota colleges and universities that are designing a new program. So this would be available to current Minnesota colleges and universities that are developing experimental program or seeking approval for a program through the Board of Teaching, or would be available to any other program that meets the criteria laid out in the alternative certification bill passed in 2011. So I mentioned a couple programs like Urban Teachers, programs like the Relay Graduate School of Education. These are programs not currently in Minnesota, but exist nationally with a track record of increasing educator diversity and quality. Just as an example, and then I hope this answers your question, you know, more than half of all teachers that come through Urban Teachers identify as people of color. Nearly two-thirds of all participants in Relay Graduate School of Education identify as black or Latino. You know, while there are many traditional colleges of education that are talking about their plans to increase diversity, we see programs across the country that already are developing talented and diverse educators, and we would like to attract them to Minnesota.
And, Mr. Chair and members, and Grow Your Own has already up and running in a few of the school districts, so that's another program right here in Minnesota that could possibly fit within this category as well. So right now, one of the first program, first year for Grow Your Own in Minneapolis School District is 76% of their fellows are of diversity. They spend 1 year with the teacher, in the classroom with the teacher, then they have their own classroom in the next year, and they commit to teaching 3 years. You'll hear more about that program through this committee in the next week or so.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that clarification, that answer. Representative Fenton, you know, I do appreciate you bringing this bill forward and taking a look at different ways we can fill some of these teacher shortages across the state. You know, I would be very cautious, though, that we're doing things outside of our existing MinSKU or University of Minnesota system. You know, I think we have two very excellent systems set up in the state, particularly the Moorhead campus. Minnesota State Moorhead is, traditionally known. It was the teacher's college. And so they have a really excellent track record of, developing educators. And so, you know, I would prefer to go the route of working with our existing systems, our existing institutions for education. So that's, yes, just my comments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I would say that the new programs up and coming, the Grow Your Own, they're working with the University of Minnesota. So I think we're going to see more of that, but we need to get the ball rolling so that we can. And it's on the cusp of being able to take, and some of these programs we want to be able to take into greater Minnesota as well. And obviously with the campuses, the various campuses, that could be very possible if this bill is moved forward.
Any other questions? Oh, Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Fenton. You answered really my first question with Representative Lean. That was on experimental programs seeking approval from the Board of Teaching and what is meant by that. But also on line 1.15, you have highly selective means accepting less than 25% of applicants. How did you come up with that, and what does that mean, and what does it screen out, and what does it include?
Representative Fenton, did you hear the question?
You want to address that? Yeah.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenthal, I think it was the goal is to develop a competitive grant that seeks programs that are highly selective. To be frank, that number is somewhat arbitrary, and I can only speak on behalf of myself, would be open to working with Representative Fenton to find a different definition. I think somewhere it needs to be defined what selective means, or anybody could claim they're selective when they're not actually. So I'm open to working with a better working definition of what selective means, highly selective means.
Any other questions? Any other testifiers? Oh, here we go. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Cindy Crisp with the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. We oppose this bill for the same reason shared with the author in this committee last year, to essentially the same bill, and that is that it would again create and fund a competitive grant program for which there's currently only one eligible Minnesota program. We know that the words "or experimental program" have been added to the definition of an alternative program, but frankly, there's no meaningful operational definition of experimental programs in Minnesota statute or in the work of the Board of Teaching. So, and I think we've seen over the last few years some of the problems that have been addressed around teacher licensure, teacher shortages, out-of-state teachers, and so on, and issues raised in the OLA report have resulted from language that's unclear and inconsistent. So if what is intended here is that, for example, non-conventional programs would be eligible, then I think it's important to have language in the bill that reflects that reality. Otherwise, experimental program, you know, experimental, like pornography is in the eye of the beholder, right? We also previously raised questions about some specific elements of the program, and I was just going to mention one today in the interest of time, and it actually goes to the question that was just raised, and that is the definition of highly selective. We really find this meaningless as a measure of quality, and let me give you just one hypothetical example. You could have one program that admitted no candidates with GPAs above 2.5. So the average GPA of those 25% admitted would be 2.5 or less. Another program might have no candidates with GPAs below 2.75. So 75% of those applicants excluded would have higher GPAs than the 25% admitted to the first program. So it's hard to assert that on this basis, these two programs could be judged to have met the same high standard in any meaningful way. And I appreciate Mr. Seller's suggestion that that's something that could be revisited if this bill proceeds. Finally, I would just echo a couple of other comments, and that is that particularly with enrollment down in teacher licensure programs across the state, we would suggest that state funding might be better used to build on the investment you've made in the state's higher education institutions by encouraging and supporting candidates to pursue teacher licensure in one of our 31 public and private teacher preparation institutions and encouraging and supporting their own innovations. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Hearing or seeing no other comments, Representative Fenton, any final word?
Again, I think this does open the door to have many other very highly qualified programs be available for these grants, such as the Grow Your Own is actually approved by the Board of Teaching, and we're going to see more and more of that, and they work with the University of Minnesota. So thank you, members, for your time today, and I move that this be laid over for possible inclusion.
All right. Chair will lay House File 3165 over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Representative Applebaum, before he comes to the table, I just wanted to let the members know that Sue Vekage, who's the wife of the Minnesota Board Chair, Mike Vekage, passed away this morning. And just to keep her or the family in mind. So. Representative Applebaum, good to see you.
Good to see you too. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 2965 before you this afternoon.
I should mention House File 2965 will be held over for possible inclusion at the end of the testimony, so go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have authored this bill with two main objectives in mind. Number one, to establish Minnesota as the nation's leader in post-secondary education affordability and student loan debt relief, and number two, to encourage young people to continue their education and careers in Minnesota. You may remember that I came before this committee last year with a bill similar to this one. What's changed in this new version is, in an effort to satisfy those concerned with its potential cost, I have significantly scaled back this credit, which now includes an income-based phase-out for individual filers at the modified adjusted gross income level of $65,000 and at $130,000 for married couples filing jointly. While that provision of my proposal has changed, members, what remains the same is that student loan debt continues to hold our economy back and is perhaps the greatest burden facing young professionals, students, working families, and several other groups of people in Minnesota. With the fifth highest average amount of student loan debt in the United States, it is necessary for Minnesota to make post-secondary education options much more affordable. Mr. Chair and members, this bill provides much-needed relief for Minnesota taxpayers carrying student loan debt while encouraging those with such burdens to call Minnesota home and become a part of our tax base. In particular, this bill creates a refundable tax credit of up to $5,000 for principal and interest payments made on student loans. An individual or a parent who is making such payments is eligible to claim the credit if the student's loans are related to an undergraduate or graduate school eligible for state student aid or one that participates in the federal Pell Grant program. Private student loan debtors are also eligible to claim this credit. Indeed, if the amount of the credit an individual is eligible to receive exceeds that person's individual tax liability, the Commissioner of Revenue shall refund the excess amount to that individual. Mr. Chair and members, this legislation represents perhaps the boldest initiative enacted by any state to address the student loan debt crisis and also encourages those who bear it to remain in Minnesota. With that, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to turn it over to one of my testifiers. There'll be two that I know of so far today, but I'd like to introduce the first one.
All right. Welcome, and again, state your name for the record.
Marshall Thompson. I live in St. Louis Park. I represent Viewakeen. And I'm a teacher in the Osseo School District. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the members of the committee. I'm a teacher in the Osseo District. Did I say that?
Yes, you did.
Okay. My goal today is just to share a little bit about my family's experience with student loans and to tell you a little bit about how this bill in particular could help my family and the thousands of others in this state that are suffering and dealing with crippling student loan debt. First, my story. I come from a single-parent home. My mom didn't have the means to pay for any of my college education, so I found myself having to figure out how to navigate all of this myself, both in college and then after college. And I'll tell you, the process is super confusing, complicated, and really discouraging at times. My wife and I met at St. Cloud State University, and then we went back for our master's. She's a teacher, too, in the Osseo District. She's an elementary school librarian. After all of our college experience, we found ourselves over $100,000 in debt. For reference, my mortgage was $200,000 in debt, or, you know, $200,000 when we bought our house. So that's over half of my house. We're currently in an income-based repayment plan with the federal government, hoping for the public service loan forgiveness after 120 qualifying payments, which if you make every payment in order, which is tough, that's 10 years. There are a ton of pressures facing our young families in this state. The first 10 years of a home mortgage is really, really hard. They're the toughest because the mortgage payment represents a huge portion of your salary because you're making less, right? That's also a time when the student loan debt is the greatest. So you have all these pressures along with the medical bills, car payments, utilities, insurance costs, kids. If you can afford kids, that's a huge cost. Our furnace went out a couple years ago, and we weren't able to save. We didn't have a savings. We had to put the whole thing, you know, it's the middle of January. We had to put the whole thing on a credit card. We've spent the better part of the last 10 years trying to navigate and figure out how to manage our student loan debt, along with this other debt, which we balance between, you know, direct loans and no interest credit cards. And you try to bounce them around so that you pay as little interest as possible. And this is a family, I mean, I'm a teacher, my wife's a teacher, we have a family, we both have pretty stable jobs, and we're suffering this, like, constant weight of pressure from our student loan debt, and it's really, really hard at times. I think about the $5,000 tax credit and what that would have meant to my family 10 years ago. I think, wow, we maybe could have saved a little bit and prepared for emergencies like when my furnace went out. Maybe we wouldn't have had to depend on credit cards as much as we did. Probably would have saved like 100 arguments about what bills to pay when, because that's a big deal too. I guess the bottom line is, I feel like this bill in front of you would make a huge impact. It'd make a real tangible impact, a real relief for young families in this state. So I'm hopeful that you consider this, and I thank you all for working to address such a tough issue. It means a lot to me, my family, and a lot of other families around this state.
Thank you very much. You have at least one other testifier?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Paul Manning.
Hello.
Is it Paul?
Yep, Paul Manning.
Manning? You have relatives in Fergus Falls, by any chance?
Not that I know of. Oh. I have heard of the Mannings
there
in Fergus
Falls.
There
are some Mannings up there. Yeah, okay.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Representatives and Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Manning, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group, MPIRG, which is a nonpartisan, student-directed nonprofit which trains students to engage in the community and take collective action in the public interest for students throughout the state of Minnesota. I'm a product of Minnesotan education, K-12, and I'm continuing that education at McAllister College in St. Paul. Looking to the past, I'm thankful to the state for the wonderful education I've received, but looking to the future, I and many of my classmates have many concerns, the largest being the difficulty of student debt. There aren't many things... There aren't many things I look for in a first job, but with student debt weighing on my mind and wallet, I know that my options are limited. I have friends who have recently graduated that have avoided careers in the teaching profession based on their student debt load and the salary that they'd receive as a teacher. I know that my options are certainly limited in that extent as well. However, if our state were to have a fair incentive for newly graduated students to stay working in Minnesota, that burden would be greatly eased. Not only would this tax credit help excellent workers stay in the state, but it would pay itself off in 10 years as a result of increase in productivity in the state of Minnesota. The fact is, a more productive state is better for every Minnesotan. I've talked with students whose dreams of entrepreneurship have also been put on the back burner to student debt repayment. In contrast, I imagine how wonderful it would be to be working in the first state that says building something yourself is something that you will not, that will not only provide a livelihood you're proud of, but will help your neighbors as a result. Being a student and part of a community of students, I recognize that any help for student debt is excellent, and this bill certainly does help in that important way. There isn't an action that I see being more timely and more relevant to the situation of thousands of students in Minnesota. I urge you to support this measure to better our state and provide individuals with the means to take responsibility for their dreams and make something we can all be proud of. Thanks.
Thank you. And I show one more name on the list, and I'll, do you have any other customers that you're aware of?
Yeah, Ryan.
This Ryan Kennedy?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Kennedy. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group, MPIRG. Paul is one of our wonderful students, a freshman, too. Can you believe that? Thank you for having me here today. Thank you to Representative Applebaum for introducing this bill. This is actually about my seventh time testifying in front of this committee on this piece of legislation specifically. We've been working on a number of iterations on this proposal for since the 2009 session. Look at me. Hopefully this is the year. But one of the, I just want to layer on one other thing. This bill really is going to do four things. It's going to induce primarily low-income high school students in Minnesota to go to college in the first place. We know that there are a lot of college-qualified low-income students and middle-income students that actually don't have the means, and cost itself is what's prohibiting folks from going and seeking college, even though they are qualified and they could get into many wonderful colleges across the state of Minnesota. will also help us recruit college graduates, young folks from other states that are graduating from colleges in other states, might have grown up in other states, that are graduating with this student loan debt and are looking around the country for states with programs like this. Currently, Maine has a program. There's a couple other states that have very smaller versions of this program, but like Representative Applebaum said, this would be the most robust program like this in the country if and when we pass it here out of Minnesota. Another thing we can do is retain folks, retain good, qualified Minnesota graduates that might be looking to go to San Francisco, Denver, even Chicago for some of those higher paying jobs that may not, you know, be available, or they might say, hey, I don't know if I can make this work in Minnesota. With this, it really helps that debt load and helping pay that off. So leading into the fourth point, really what this is about is young people who are putting off some of those very decisions that were talked about before, getting married, buying a house, taking on a mortgage. The teacher that was up here before, it's even worse, you know, for the folks that are graduating now, where they're not even able to take on that mortgage. They're not able to take on those car payments. And they're not able to contribute to our economy because they're busy paying off their own debt. And so really, this would be an economic driver, and we've worked with economists from the University of Minnesota that show that in the long run, this pays off for the state of Minnesota, and the increased tax revenue that will come in will very likely offset the cost up front. So, thank you.
All right, thank you. I should have asked before if there are any questions of the other two testifiers or any of the three. Apparently not. Any other folks in the audience who would like to testify? I don't see any, so Representative Applebaum, any closing comments?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You know, in this short session, there is no higher priority for me personally than to help establish our state as the nation's leader in college affordability and student loan debt relief. I feel that the legislature hasn't done nearly enough to reverse the disinvestments in higher education that we've been seeing for a decade now, which has left too many Minnesotans and their families being adversely affected by seemingly insurmountable amounts of student loan debt. And targeting tax relief to these Minnesotans, I believe, is an important first step in fostering a state where everyone has an affordable way to continue their education. In closing, I ask that you vote in favor of House File 2965, which has the potential to help thousands of Minnesotans and their families immediately. At the same time, this legislation is a significant step in ensuring that Minnesota is the nation's leader in post-secondary school affordability and will encourage young people to continue their educations and careers in our wonderful state. Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation. And now the House, or the Chair, will House File 2965 will be laid open for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Thank you much, very much. next bill today, House File 2924, Representative Portman.
I was going to say good morning. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon. Works as long as it is good evening. So, welcome. Good to see you. And please begin your testimony. House File 2924, again, will be laid open for possible inclusion at the end of your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for having a hearing on my bill this afternoon. And I didn't know if I needed one of my colleagues to move the bill.
No.
You've done that.
We're all set.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I don't need to repeat the data that's already been shared with you, that student debt is a significant problem both in the country and in the state of Minnesota. Here in the state of Minnesota, the average debt for a student who has debt is $30,894, putting it at the fifth highest in the country. 70% of people who graduate from a four-year school have debt now. And state funding for full-time equivalent college students dropped 45% from 2001 to 2013. We saw time and time again when we were in deficits, huge whacks made to higher education budgets. And our institutions, the University of Minnesota and the Minsky institutions, had really no choice but to jack up tuition. And as a result, we have a lot of students who are carrying a lot of debt, and some of it very high interest debt. In 2013, we authorized a program for the Office of Higher Education to renegotiate debt and help students through a pilot program to consolidate and lower their interest rates. The problem is we didn't provide OHE any funding, and so they are only able to offer what they said informally in my office is the kind of rates that banks would offer the same students for the same loans. So in other words, they can't really buy down high interest loans for people with a more challenging credit history. What House File 2924 would do is it would appropriate $5 million to the Office of Higher Education to fund the pilot program so that they could help more students, so they could help people with credit scores that are lower than 720. I think there's a lot of people in this room who probably would say that we don't have credit scores of 720. That's a pretty high score. And people with lower credit scores are probably people who need help the most. So, Mr. Chair, I have with me today Kane Russell.
Yes, sir.
Basil, University of Minnesota Morris, and he'd like to offer some testimony.
Hi.
Welcome to the committee.
Hi.
State your name, please.
My name is Kane Basil. I'm currently a senior with 1 year remaining at the University of Minnesota Morris. I'm going to college to pursue a Communications Arts and Literature license for grades 5 through 12. My story starts in my junior year of high school. Growing up in poverty has never been easy. My wonderful single mother just lost her job and was spiraling into a deep depression. Being a good son and knowing that my family needed money, I started working close to 30 hours a week to pay our bills. This was never easy for a college student. Going from school to play practice until 6, speech practice until 6:30, volunteering until 7:30, working until 1 in the morning, and back home doing homework until at least 2 in the morning, then finally going to bed at 6 to wake up for jazz choir early the next morning. I enjoyed being busy, but soon it was taking its toll, and something had to give. The first thing that fell through the cracks after being stretched so thin was my homework, which made my grades decline. I lost my 4.0 GPA, but even worse, I was losing my ambition as well. I no longer wanted to do all these activities that I loved doing so much because I focused on work instead of schoolwork and extracurricular activities. I continued this hectic schedule all through my senior year of high school in order for my family to continue to pay our bills. But before I left for college, my mother got another job, and everything was looking up. I was extremely excited to start at college because it was time for me to do what I was passionate about, helping people. I didn't quite know what I wanted to do, but as long as I was bettering people's lives, I was willing to think about it. Before my sophomore year, I realized what was important to me, which was being in school. It was the one place that I found a safe haven from a hectic schedule, and I could relax and just learn. I loved it. Schools allowed me to forget everything that I had to do afterwards and allowed me to be a teenager again. I realized I wanted to be a teacher so I could become able to give the same refuge to the students that have a similar family story as I did, growing up in poverty. Though my family was extremely poor and my family did not have the money needed to pay for college, I thought everything would be fine and scholarships and grants would cover my schooling. How wrong I was. My expected family contribution, or my EFC on my FAFSA, was zero. The government knew that my family had no money to pay for college, but here I was, needing to get student loans for my first year in college. This trend continued to cover my college costs. I have currently borrowed over $30,000, not to mention the year that I currently have remaining in my student teaching. The scariest thing to me now is what happens after I'm done with college. How am I going to pay all of these loans, pay for a wedding, pay for a house, pay for myself to live while doing a job that no longer gets as much respect from both students and legislature. With over $30,000 in debt and what could be close to $40,000 after my next year in school, I am extremely apprehensive that I will not be able to live comfortably, not to mention that the projected $40,000 will take years for me to pay off, resulting in me paying student loans as I try to get married, start a family, and eventually send those children off to college. This makes me apprehensive. I know I want to be in the classroom because I can help students that are being raised in poverty much like I was, but for the compensation that I will receive, I'm slightly less excited and have a growing concern about starting my life shackled to these loans. One way that would help myself and many others like me is being able to refinance my student loans. Some loans that I have are very close to 5% interest, which results in my student loans payments being attributed to the interest rather than the actual loan, making me pay for these loans even longer. Students going to college and trying to better themselves and their education should not be punished for wanting to succeed. Students going to college should not be a tool for people to make money. Students going to college have the right to refinance loans for the same percentage of interest that the government can borrow money. So right now I implore you to understand my situation and the situation of many others like me. Everyone wants to change the world, and we have a way right now that we can, and the ability for more students to refinance student loans is one way. Gandhi once said, "You must be the change that you wish to see in the world." So here I am, trying to be that change, trying to make a difference that will not only help me, but many others like me. I share my story so that you can understand what it is like to live in poverty, and the government to know that you and your family are both living in poverty, but still accrue tens of thousands of dollars in student loans. I'm currently asking for a small way for the aftermath of college to be a bit more manageable, and one way the state legislature can do that is by allowing more students, especially those with lower credit scores, to refinance loans that we receive in college. Thank you.
Before the next testifier, Representative Portman, did you have an amendment? Did you want to deal with that?
Mr. Chair, yes. If the committee considers including House File 2924 in an omnibus higher ed bill, I would encourage you to modify it with the A160950 amendment that was drafted by the Office of Higher Education to address some technical issues in the bill.
Okay, I can move the A16 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, that amendment then is adopted.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. And now I'm joined by Anna. How do you say your last name?
Reget. Anna Reget.
Take it away.
Good afternoon, committee and Mr. Chair. Like she said, I'm Anna Reget. Unfortunately, I'm fighting a cold right now, like many other people in this room, so bear with me a little bit. But I'm here to testify on behalf of Education Minnesota and for the House File 2924 about student debt refinancing options. I am a junior at the University of Minnesota with growing student loan debt and unavoidable high interest rates. Despite this, I am currently working towards achieving my dream of becoming a teacher. From a low-income household and single parent, I have been fighting to battle two jobs in a 30 credit load in order to complete my job in time or complete my degree in time. I am here in favor of this bill because it would be a great option for students who are like me with unavoidable low credit scores and are fighting to receive a degree in something they love. However, I'm not just here to share my own story. I'm here to share the stories that I have taken from others collectively about their concerns about their student loan debt. I'm a part of recruitment and retention at the University of Minnesota, and I have heard collectively from students and first-year teachers within teaching that their crippling student loans are hindering their growth as an individual and as a person. Due to their large debt and consequently low credit scores, these students will struggle taking out more loans to do normal milestones in their life. They are struggling in areas like buying a home, financing a car, returning for more school, or participating in professional development. Maddie, going into the teaching profession next year, is incredibly worried that she will not be able to own a dog because of the burden and the worry that she has from her crippling loan debt. These levels of debt our students and future educators are facing and reaching are preventing these individuals from experiencing the rest of their lives and growing. I believe that adding more money to the refinancing program to help students with unavoidable low credit scores will help them get their debt under control and prosper as a person. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Portman, you mentioned something about the Office of Higher Education not being able to really save the students much money right now with current funding, or is that what you said?
Mr. Chair, when we authorize the Office of Higher Education to put a pilot program together to buy down student loan interest rates, we didn't fund them, so they have to price the interest rate for the students like any risk-taking institution would. And so, informally in my office, they shared that they weren't really going to be able to help some of the folks with the highest interest rates because those are people who have poor credit scores, and so they wouldn't be able to price that risk any better than a bank.
But would this funding then would change that?
What
the rate might be?
I don't know what sort of rate that they would be able, credit scores they would be able to go down to in terms of helping people. Okay. Just my perspective on it is that we have a $900 million budget surplus, about $550 million of it we can expect to recur. So when we look at things we could do with one-time money, a one-time appropriation of $5 million to see what the Office of Higher Education could do, might be a really good use of some one-time money.
Any questions? Representative Rosenthal, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hortman, thank you for bringing this bill. I think it's a great start. I know as a homeowner, if I had a 5% loan right now, I would refinance immediately, and students should be able to do that too. And so anything we can do to help our students have a lower payment helps the state as a whole and helps our economy. So thank you.
Okay. Any final word?
Just thank you very much for having the hearing. I have two other bills which you might not have time to hear, but you should strongly consider freezing tuition at every institution. We didn't freeze tuition at last year. And I have another bill that would increase student grant amount and lower the assigned family responsibility. I think one of the things that you heard the previous testifier say is that his assigned family responsibility was too high. And we're finding a lot of kids who are in sort of middle-class families being presumed that their families can pay a lot more than they really can. So anything that we can do to help alleviate student debt, I think Minnesotans will really be grateful for.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. The chair will move House File 2924 be held over for possible inclusion. Thank you. As amended. Everybody hear that?
I got it, buddy.
Representative Lean, you're up there. Representative Lean, welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Yeah.
And I will move House File 2729 before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill.
That's great. Thank you.
2729 is a bill that would establish a student debt forgiveness program for people who completed a post-secondary degree and work for an employee or an employer as a full-time employee in Greater Minnesota. Now, as we've heard from the other two bills, student debt is a problem, and I understand. I really appreciate us having a conversation today about what we can do for people with existing student debt. But I understand to really get at the heart of the issue, we need to be taking a look at what's causing the increase in tuition at institutions of higher education. Getting a handle on that at the forefront is, I think, the best thing we can do. But we do have to take into consideration solutions that we can help for people who have already gone to school, already completed degrees, and now they're out there in the workforce with this debt. And to share a couple numbers, there are approximately 327,000 people who live in Greater Minnesota above the age of 25 who have attended some sort of a post-secondary degree. Now, we've already heard some of the stats about Minnesota being the state with the fifth highest average student debt in the country and the third highest in terms of students out there who are holding debt. And so to kind of put some of this together, to take that average amount of student debt people have against the number of people out there in Greater Minnesota with those student debts, we're looking at about $10.1 billion in student debt. Now, if we were even to just cut that number in half, we could be adding roughly 1.5 to 1.6% basically GDP back into Greater Minnesota. That's money that people would have in their pockets to be spending on new homes, weddings, having children, buying new cars, starting retirement funds, all the while not paying interest on that money. And so kind of taking a look at it a little bit more, the most recent numbers as far as GDP growth for the state show a 1.4% growth between 2013 and 2014. So, you know, we could actually do more for our economy by doing some debt forgiveness for people out there. And I can walk through the bill at this time now. Section 1, Subdivision 1 are some definitions of the bill. Subdivision 2 is establishing the program. Subdivision 3 lays out the eligibility requirements, largely the student be a employee be a Minnesota resident, having a qualifying student loan balance, have earned a degree from a post-secondary institution, have worked for a full-time for an employee, Greater Minnesota employee for a 12-month period,
have a debt-to-income ratio of 10%, and also the applicant is eligible to apply once a year for this program up to 5 years. Subdivision 4 lays out some of the terms of the application. Subdivision 5 prioritizes applicants in the event there are more applicants than dollars in the program, which I assume there would be, to say that it's priority should be given, not eligibility, but just priority should be given to students with at least $5,000 in debt and are working in occupations that do not already qualify for other state or federal loan forgiveness programs. The amount of forgiveness would be the lesser of $3,000, 10% of the remaining balance of a participant's qualifying loan in the first year they apply for the program, or the remaining balance of the student's or the employee's loan.
And you also have an amendment. Do you want to deal with that at some point?
Yeah. I do, Mr. Chair. Let me just walk through the bill here. Thank you. And I'll get to that once I get down a little further.
All right.
Subdivision 8 establishes the fund within the Office of Higher Ed. Subdivision 9 lays out some reporting requirements that the office must report to the legislative committees on higher ed and economic development by February 1st of each year. And then Section 2 is a $10 million appropriation for fiscal year 17. For the program. And Mr. Chair, at this point I would like to move my amendment, the A1 amendment. And basically what this amendment would do, rather than taking the $300,000 3% administrative appropriation out of the program dollars, it would just be an additional appropriation for the Office of Higher Ed to administer the program. And so, Mr. Chair and members, with that, I don't know if folks have questions at this time, if members have questions at this time.
We probably vote on your amendment. Any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Okay, the amendment is adopted. Okay, again, back to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And at this time, I do know there are a number of folks that would like to make some comments about the bill, so I will turn it over to them.
Welcome. And state your name, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the record, my name is Evan Parker, President of the Minnesota State College Student Association. I want to thank you and the committee for the opportunity to speak today about an important piece of legislation. We also want to thank Representative Lean for bringing forward this bill. MSCSA is an association that represents the students at Minnesota's public community and technical colleges. This means we have campuses from International Falls to Winona and many communities in between. Our colleges are the workforce training engines for every region of our great state. All of our students are proud of the campuses they attend. But we most often hear from our students in greater Minnesota a deeply held belief that my campus is great and the programs offered are crucial for my town. These students are attending their local college to better their lives and to contribute to their local communities, and most want to remain there after graduation if possible. For some, job opportunities are plenty, but for others, there are fewer positions in their part of the state, and often finding a job that will allow them to live and to pay off their student debt can be a challenge. Our students currently pay the third highest tuition and fees in the nation, and even after financial aid, our students still face some of the highest costs in the country. Further, the average student debt for community and technical college students approaches $20,000. That's 2 years of college. All of these factors can make staying home after college a great challenge if there isn't a good paying job immediately available. Some move from their hometowns to find work in their field, and others continue the job search while living their daily lives and then trying to pay that debt off. House File 2729 would be a tremendous benefit to many of our hardworking students in greater Minnesota. These are the nurses in the nursing homes, the mechanics who repair the combines and tractors, the veterinary technicians who care for our livestock, and the electricians who help our homes and keep our businesses running. Some relief from the student debt that can often prevent them from purchasing a home, buying a car, or in some cases simply meeting the needs of their family would be welcome. Our state is fortunate to have strong and vibrant communities where Minnesotans raise their families and live good lives. In order to keep every region of our state strong, we need to ensure that everyone has access to an affordable and quality education. While we have made strides to address affordability over the past 4 years, work remains, and House File 2729 would give students living in every corner of Minnesota some relief from their debt, and we believe it's a worthy investment. Mr. Chair, members, thanks again for the opportunity to speak today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
All right. Thank you. I have appreciated brief, direct, concise testimony today, and if we keep that going, that'd be great. Do you have one or two more testifiers?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Welcome to the committee. And
thank you. My name is Isuru Herath. It's I-S-U-R-U, last name H-E-R-A-T-H. Again, my name is Isuru Herath. I'm a graduate student in the program at Instant Cloud of Information Assurance. I also completed my bachelor's degree in St. Cloud in Political Science and International Relations. I also went to Washington, D.C. and completed my Project Management and Litigation Technology certification at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. Before I begin, I just want to thank all of you for inviting me to speak here today. And I think my parents would be pretty proud that as a first-generation immigrant, I'm up here talking to state legislatures for the first time.
Again, welcome.
Thank you. And similar to a growing population of immigrant families in Minnesota, my family came to this country 17 years ago seeking a better life. When I came to the U.S., I didn't speak a lick of English. I only spoke the words, toilet, please, and thank you. Three essential words that got me through a good chunk of my life.
You now have the Minnesota accent.
For my parents and from any other immigrants in developing countries, obtaining a higher education and getting a degree is the only way out of poverty. My parents lived through two civil wars, went through Arab uprising, and completed their PhDs in Japan, and I was born in Japan. I speak three languages. I speak Japanese, I speak Sinhalese, and English is my last language. Konnichiwa. You know, hello in Japanese, right?
All right.
So this, usually for our communities, higher education, obtaining a PhD, or any other avenue that's usually provided for us to get out of these dire conditions is through higher education. Although I cannot compete with my parents' struggles in their upbringing in these countries, the reality is that my chance of getting into the middle class and for my partner is not foreseeable in the future. After the completion of my bachelor's degree in St. Cloud State in the summer of 2013, I saw opportunities to improve my marketability in the job market. My partner and I made conscious decisions to pursue fields that would have a high rate of return. I chose the legal field with emphasis on information assurance and completing my master's degree, and she chose the field of dentistry. Our goals were fairly simple. We're going to choose career paths which would allow us to retire our parents and develop savings to ensure emergency needs were met, and to live and start a fairly comfortable lifestyle as our lives progress together. Also, more notably, my partner had another goal. She is. Her family is among refugees. They're among refugees. They came here in the 1980s, and they lived through public assistance, and they had a number of children. And my partner struggled through public assistance, and finally was able to get a degree at St. Cloud State. As Hmong refugees, they did grow up in public assistance, and that was the only way out of the cycle of poverty that's established in the U.S. And that truly affects marginalized people and people of color. As we know, the racial disparities in Minnesota, that's already a stacked game for us. So in order to attain these goals that I established with my partner, I packed my bag, placed an air mattress in the back of my SUV, and I headed down to Georgetown, to the East Coast, during the Washington, D.C. summers with the humidity and all that, right? I was completely aware that I was not going to be able to meet the living standard of Washington, D.C., and during the beginning of the program, I slept in the back of my car, slept in the underground garage, spent the day and the night in the library, and washed up at a 24-hour gym facility every day until I got lucky and one of my African-American classmates offered their basement for free. Now, 4 years later, in 2016, I'm personally indebted to the student loan industry with a loan of $20,000. Compared to most, $20,000 figure is not seem significant, but this amount of debt is something that my parents and my family don't see in a developing country, which doesn't have any resources like this in America, and they don't see any amount of debt being incurred like this to obtain an education. Now, since I mentioned that my partner is going to dental school, Combining my partner, my partner's debt and my debt, we're looking at about $400,000 in debt. And with that reality, I'm 100% sure that we will not be able to reach that middle class income lifestyle, and our goals might not be achievable in the future. Adding to this, 3 months ago in dental school, in her first year, my partner was diagnosed with lupus, an autoimmune disorder which affects the joints and unfortunately her central nervous system. Now as I see her fingers tremble, her joints ache, and a sudden onset of seizures, the reality of that reaching that middle class has become a rather more of a grim reality, and having that loan forgiven is taking extra toll on our lives. The chances of her able to practice dentistry is something that's probably not be foreseeable in the future. Just like the medical student that was here earlier today, she had an unexpected pregnancy. The same situation with me, where we're looking at about $350,000 to $400,000 in debt, and this is all stemmed from a medical condition that we had no control over. Combined with the uncertainty of life and systemic and institutional barriers and the high rate of racial disparities in Minnesota, for myself and my peers, we are sure that we'll not be able to reach the security of the middle class. However, this bill will provide a foundation to relieve my peers from working 40 hours a week with 3 overnight shifts while going to school overtime. Some of my peers are working parents who went back to obtain a degree in order to provide their families at the age of 40. Some of these students at St. Cloud State are children of farmers, first-generation college students, who does not have any support system to get through college, and at 18 years old, they're looking at $30,000 to start their life. That's why I'm here today. This is the bill that would actually allow us, people in greater Minnesota, including minorities and marginalized populations, to start their life in a more of a marginable way than what the current system allows for.
I don't mean to stretch you short.
Yep,
we're
done.
Really short on time.
Yep, I'm done.
Okay, thank you very much
for
taking the time, and your testimony was very good.
Thanks.
Appreciate that. Representative Leon, do you have another testifier?
One more, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
If they could keep it very, very brief, we'd like to get through at least one more bill before we have to leave. We have to leave the room at 4:30. So, go ahead, proceed. Your name, please.
Kara Lipke. My name is Kara Lipke, and I'm the state chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association. Good afternoon. I'm also a student at Winona State University, and I'd like to express gratitude for the opportunity to speak on HF 2729. Since 2000, students have seen a growing disparity in the relationship between tuition and state appropriations. In 2002, the state covered 2/3 of a student's public higher education costs. As recently as now it is less than half. This trend has led to unprecedented student debt levels, and the average debt of a Minnesota State University graduate was $31,000. Many of Minnesota State University students choose to stay or relocate to greater Minnesota, and these students struggle to cover their monthly expenses of making their lives. I want to tell you quickly about a student and my friend who will benefit from this bill. His name is John Herman, and he is a State University student who is heavily involved in MSUSA, and he'll graduate this May. John started at Minnesota State in Fergus Falls, where he's from, and then transferred to Minnesota State University Moorhead to complete his bachelor's degree. Upon graduation, John plans to return home to Fergus Falls and be searching for a job. He told me the following: I have a far more advanced idea of how I can use my accumulated knowledge to make a true difference in people's lives. When I return to my community, I know that I can make a positive impact. John will graduate with $19,000 in student loan debt, and this bill will reduce his burden and help so many students like him reduce their burden. John and our fellow students will greatly benefit from this proposal, or from this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And I don't mean to cut short, but we are short of time. So, Representative Leon, do you want to make your final motion?
Mr. Chair and members, I appreciate your time and attention that we spent this afternoon on this issue.
And House File 2729 will be held open for possible inclusion. Thank you very much. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, and I apologize for not giving more time to your bill, but...
Well, I'm disappointed too, Mr. Chair, and yeah. I don't want to belabor that right now because
right.
I'd like to invite the Vice Chancellor up.
I'm going to stretch past 4:30 a little bit
okay.
for your benefit.
Thank you. I'm going to introduce the bill, and I'd like to move House File 2547, and I think to be laid over for possible
yes,
inclusion.
That is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm bringing a bill forward that's different than the bills we've been talking about today, which have been primarily on student loans. For most college students, success means having internal motivation, vision, and a strong support system, and a good learning environment at the bare minimum. For students in recovery, the college experience can be even more challenging. 82% of college students drink alcohol. 31% meet diagnostic criteria for alcohol abuse. Access to alcohol and drugs is plentiful and difficult to avoid in most college settings. There are approximately 400 to 750,000 young college-ready young people exiting treatment programs and maintaining sobriety each year, and these numbers, while hard to track, are growing. The need for recovery support among college-age students with a former substance abuse disorder is being recognized, and this bill seeks to put into place a research-based pilot program to further a model of a residential collegiate recovery learning community at the University of Minnesota Rochester. And why the University of Minnesota Rochester? Actually, I approached both the president of the University of Minnesota and the chancellor over a year ago about this concept. There wasn't a lot of interest at that time. And then, unbeknownst to me, the University of Minnesota Rochester was working on the very same thing, so it's actually accidental that this happened.
Fortuitous,
absolutely. But actually, it's the perfect fit. They're a uniquely positioned college because of their niche focus on health sciences education, and they may actually be the starting point in support of Representative Barrett's bill that we heard yesterday, actually. Wasn't it yesterday? I think it was. Because of their strong record of innovation and research on student learning and development, and also because of the small, supportive student environment that they have, which focuses on community and potential. They've already begun building a recruitment strategy, and we're asking for your support for a strong model to be developed for future programs. And why do I feel so strongly about this bill? As a parent who's participated in the Hazleton Parent Program, I know that there are limited placements for college-age students in recovery in the state of Minnesota, and Augsburg is primarily the one that's recommended. The college environment is difficult, especially for a young person who needs to fit in while in recovery. The exposure to drugs and alcohol, and therefore the opportunity to use and abuse substances, is great. A supportive, understanding environment of peers is the best chance for these students in recovery to be successful. Some, unfortunately, have yet to find that place. I'd like to ask our Vice Chancellor, Lori Carroll, to share a little bit more information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
Representative yeah. Norton, thank you yeah. for this.
State your name for the record, please.
Lori Carroll, Vice Chancellor of the University of Minnesota, Rochester. And it's just been mentioned, at least a quarter to three quarters of a million students, potential students, leave treatment and enter a long-term lifestyle of recovery, or have the potential to do so, every year in the United States. Currently, the CDC is meeting in Atlanta at this very moment, addressing this issue as well. The president has spoken today, as have students who have been involved in collegiate recovery programs. There are 40 such programs nationwide, and a recent meta-analysis has taught us something, that these students have special needs and they have special contributions to make to higher education and to our workforce. Their special needs can be met with living learning communities that provide a sense of belonging and accountability and structured support. A meta-analysis has shown us that students who are in collegiate recovery programs succeed, that is, they are retained and graduate at greater rates than their peers. Not only are they academically successful, they are more likely to be leaders. A lifestyle of recovery is one that focuses on voluntary sobriety, personal wellness, and citizenship. So those results about civic engagement and graduation rates that are higher than peers are very encouraging. At the University of Minnesota Rochester, we're also interested in the unique contributions of such students. As they are civically engaged, they can be leaders in our campus community and our region and this state. Those are important contributions. Why are we interested in supporting these students and their success? They are interested disproportionately in the health sciences. One of the things we've learned in our innovative model at UMR is that students who are successful in health sciences have resilience. And it's a resilience that is measurable. We're measuring it. And it's a resilience that comes from a personal life story, an encounter with healthcare in childhood or adolescence. Many of our students are already cancer survivors. They have high resilience, and they are going to contribute in unique ways to healthcare, as you might imagine. Students in recovery are also students with such stories, and stories that have produced a resilience and drive and unique perspective because they've been in treatment in adolescence, designed to be committed to healthcare and health sciences for their career. They are ready to be successful and to contribute. So not only are we interested in them because they're interested in health science, we also want to study the results of this pilot so that we can share what we learn about best practice with the rest of the higher education institutions in the state. Students who have been through treatment and are in long-term recovery deserve to be supported in all of Minnesota's higher education institutions. We want to learn how to do it and do it well, and then we want to sustain it and share what we learn. I'm very grateful that you've taken these extra few minutes to listen to this testimony. I appreciate the bill, and I appreciate your focus on student success.
It's a very important issue, and we didn't want to rush it, although we are rushed a little bit.
Yes.
So you did very well, and Representative Norton, any...
I will just say I'm not going to pass this around, but these guys have done their homework. They have lots of great data and research, and what I'm asking for is in the bill. It's an amount to start the program and of $257,000. It's not a terribly large amount, and then $179,000 ongoing to do the research for the next couple of years. So that's my request, Mr. Chair, and I really hope the committee feels as strongly as I do that these kids deserve our support.
We're hoping that we have a budget to work with eventually. So.
I hope so too, Mr. Chair.
Would you care to make a motion?
I would move that House File 2547 be laid over for possible inclusion.
All right. There we go. With that, I hope that we have finished, but we have two more bills to do. So I hate to inform you, but be back here at 6 o'clock. Not here, room 500 North. 500 North at 6 o'clock, and then we'll wrap up our agenda. That time. So we are now in recess. Reconvene the Higher Education Policy and Finance. We have two bills left to be heard tonight. And we'll begin with Representative of 2546.
I would, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2546 to be laid over, passed and laid over for possible inclusion, and I also have a D1 amendment.
Would you like to take care of that?
I would like to. Mr. Chair, we have a complete DE1, completely reworking the bill thanks to the staff, so I need to move the DE1, please.
Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the DE1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is actually a constituent bill. Many of you get contacted by constituents, and sometimes they're compelling enough that you want to do something. And
I'm not mentioning my constituent's name or bringing her here because I think it would embarrass her. But after my conversation with her and what she called me for was some help, she and her husband had a son. He went to school. He took out some loans, and they took out some loans to help him go to school. And within months, either before or right after his graduation, I can't remember the exact timing, her husband had a heart attack and died. And so she is working as a secretary on a single income, and she has a huge student debt loan for her son that they took out during his 4 years in college. And the son has some debt too, so it is shared. Because originally I said, well, can't you give it to your son? And she said, well, he already has his own. So this was our help for him. So she's in a position where everybody we called, every person that the staff helped me find to talk to her, they just said there is really nothing that we can do for you. You don't qualify. And frankly, you know, I've served on higher ed my whole time, my whole 10 years here, and most often we focus on student debt, not the parents. And most of the time that's because parents have, you know, and when they take out debt like that, are the place in their life that they can start being helpful and pay off their students' debt load and the loan that for that. But in this instance, we have a woman who is trying to make ends meet alone and, of course, grieving. It's pretty close. And she can't find any relief. So what I did was I talked to the staff. We wrote a bill. We undid the bill and we wrote another bill to try to address the Office of Higher Education's concerns because, as you heard earlier, the department's trying to make sure they can keep their interest rates low, and we didn't want to, I hate to use this term, but, you know, poison the well by putting in someone that maybe would default and cause their interest rates to go up for students. So we've created a separate entity for parents who might have a permanent disability or death. So, and it's with extreme, I mean, it's very, very narrow. I've carved this down as narrow as I can. And in working with the department, it really needs just a tiny bit of money. And I'm not even sure my constituent qualifies, to tell you the truth. So it's not necessarily for her at this point. She doesn't even know I'm doing this. But there are parents and situations that come up like this. And the department says, well, if we do a small amount and put it out there, let's see if there are others out there. And if there are, fine. You know, if we have a higher need, then we could come back in future years and ask for some funds for a parent emergency parent account. Because most of the time it is students in this era, unfortunately, that are carrying the debt more, I think, than in past years. So, Mr. Chair, that's what this is. It creates a very small account. I think we left an open appropriation at the end. Oh, it says $500,000, and it could be more or less than that. It's, in my mind, it's flexible. It's just putting something out there to help people in very significant hardships. So that's the bill.
Unlike other bills we heard today that we're buying down, forgiving, but this is just refinancing.
It's just refinancing the loans at a lesser amount, yeah. And, you know, if we do move ahead with something in the line of a tax credit, I'm not always the hugest fan of tax credits, particularly for those, you know, with a lot of wealth, but for a family like this, something like that might help her too if she qualified, and she probably would because I'm sure her income's far under $65,000 working as a secretary. But I, you know, that bill may not pass. I think its fiscal note's considerably higher than my little bill here. So, yeah, so this is just a separate fund for emergency situations.
Okay. Any questions from the committee members? Pretty straightforward.
It is.
Would you like to renew your motion?
Oh, sure. I guess I have to do that. Well, I'd like to renew House File 2546 as amended to pass and be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Okay. Murphy, Aaron, Representative Murphy. You have waited all day. Not quite.
Not that late. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right now, I'm not confined by time. So relax.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, and I am glad to be here this evening to talk with you about House File 2576, which is the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Awareness Program.
Okay, I'll move House File 2576 for possible approval.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And
I do. is an amendment, and it is technical in nature, and after talking with council, we wanted to just delete one line in the bill that is redundant. And I would ask for your support.
Okay. I move House File A1. Any questions, comments? Probably. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
I'll just tell you briefly about the bill, and then I've got a couple of testifiers, if that's okay, Mr. Chair. So this bill takes advantage of a federal program that forgives some student loans for people who work in public service, defined as working for a public employer or a 501c3.
Just before you, I'm not sure if we should move the mics. One mic is coming up.
Is it me?
I don't know where the speakers are at. Yeah, let's see how that works.
Is this better?
It is.
No.
We may have to go out in the hall. But it probably is that microphone there. But so we'll just proceed.
Okay. A little bit like Rudolph's nose, don't you think?
Yeah, maybe tip it down.
Tip it
like that.
So it's dirty. All right. Well, I'm going to plow through.
Yeah.
Okay, this bill takes advantage of a federal program that forgives some student loans for people who work in public service, defined as working for a public employer or a 501c3 nonprofit for 10 years while making payments on your loans. After 10 years, whatever is left of your loans would be forgiven if it's a federal direct loan. This is a program that's already available, but only about 15% of Minnesotans who are eligible take advantage of it. And by asking employers in public service to notify their employees once a year, more Minnesotans will be able to take advantage of this federal program. It will come at no cost to the state and no cost to the enrollee or the participant. And I know you've been talking about student debt all day long. Minnesota students are carrying the fifth highest amount of debt, student debt, in the nation. And we know that is impairing their ability to buy a home and start a family or own a car and really proceed in the life that they've earned having graduated from college and work or in their career. And so I would ask for your strong consideration of this piece of legislation tonight. And with that, I'd like to invite testifiers to come up.
All right.
I have three. Mr. Hager. Yes?
Maybe you can slide the mic some direction that those quits you on.
Push it over there.
The one thing is clear, it's working.
That's good.
Yeah. Welcome to the table and again, state your name, course.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is James Hager. I'm testifying as a staff person from Education Minnesota and testifying in favor of the bill. Just wanted to add a couple comments to Representative Murphy's comments. She mentioned that only 15% of people who could be taking advantage of the program are currently signed up to do so. And that means that those people are unfortunately paying more, in many cases, than they need to be in their monthly payments, and that there'll be less for them to be to have forgiven if they sign up for the program down the road. And so it's an important bill, not just in terms of making sure that people understand the program and can take advantage of it, but also the timeliness of it is important in making sure that they do that as soon as possible. And we'd just add to Representative Murphy's comments that not only is this something that is good for those individuals, but when we look at how we can recruit and retain people to jobs where we have shortages, things like teachers and nurses, this is a great bill because it allows those types of employees to take advantage and get loan forgiveness. And so it would allow our schools and our hospitals and those kind of things in greater Minnesota and in the metro area to take advantage of that. In addition, finally, we really support the bill in part because of the way it will help the state's economy. As Representative Murphy mentioned, people are delaying things like buying cars and homes, getting married, having kids because of student debt. This would free up resources that they'd be able to spend locally, and that would support the state's economy. Finally, I would just note that we worked with the City of Duluth and St. Louis County to see if they would voluntarily start to do what the bill is asking everyone to do, and they have done that. And about a month ago, they sent the information that the bill requires to their employees. They reported a couple things back. First off, they reported that their employees loved hearing from the employer about this. A lot of them didn't know about the program, really appreciated it, and that the information was made available in a really easy way to take advantage of. The second thing they reported, and we did follow up just to make sure before the committee, is that it was very easy for employers to take advantage of. The materials are available online, and the Office of Higher Ed would make sure that they were available for employers to find it in an easy way. They could just attach them and email them out to employees, making sure that they got that information. So I'll pause there, Mr. Chair, and happy to take any questions that members have.
Questions? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just because we had so much kind of feedback through the mics and stuff, did you say, Representative Murphy, that they have to pay for 10 years and then they're eligible? Is that what I heard you say? That's the federal program? Because in my notes it doesn't say how long they pay.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, they need to be in a public service position or for not working for them or a nonprofit for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And they have to be paying off their loans for those 10 years and be in good standing in their loan repayments. And if they've met those two conditions, then the balance of their direct federal student loan would be forgiven.
Yes,
Representative. Oh, okay, great. So way back when I had student loans, they were paid over 10 years and then we were done. So I'm assuming student loans are maybe longer now, otherwise it wouldn't make any sense. Do you know, so how much potentially could be forgiven? Do you have any sense as to like how much money we're talking?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, so that is how the structure for paying back student loans did start. What the federal government found is that many people, based on their income and how much they owed, were not able to make their payments in a way that they could pay them off in 10 years. And so they have come up with a number of income-based repayment options. Essentially, people who want to do this program at the federal level also then join an income-based repayment option. So their payments are lowered each month. They have a little bit more money in their pocket. That also means that their debt stays a little higher. And that's the sort of balance that is then forgiven at the end of the 10 years. We do see, you know, various amounts in terms of what people expect to have forgiven. As you've heard many times today, the average student loan debt is around $31,000 in the state. You know, if people get into a fairly low-paying job, they may get, you know, a large chunk of that forgiven. Others that are going into, you know, advanced degrees and things like that may also have a very large amount. We've also had teachers, though, that based on their employment and where they worked, ended up, they expect to have about $1,000 or $2,000 forgiven at the end.
That is one more question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you had also mentioned the testimony that nurses and hospitals and things like that would benefit, but I thought it was for public servants. And so is a nurse considered a public servant in a hospital?
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, it depends on the employer. So a nurse that works for Anoka, the treatment center in Anoka, for instance, would be a public employee. A nurse who works for St. Peter would be a public employee. A nurse who works for County would be a public employee. A nurse like my daughter who works at Masonic Kids Hospital, which is part of the university, I think she would be considered a public employee as well, but I'm not positive about that one. Nurses, teachers, firefighters, police officers, people who work for counties, for cities, local units of government, they would all be eligible.
I don't know if you have any numbers, but do you have a sense as to, you know, any numbers of how much money could be forgiven in a year or 2 years or 3 years, just so we have a sense in the committee what, you know, how much relief we're offering to students?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, we unfortunately don't have hard numbers on that. One thing to note is the program started in 2007 at the federal level, and so actually the first people that will be forgiven under the program will be in October of 2017. And so part of the challenge is that essentially this is all projected forgiveness. Thankfully, people's payments that are made when they sign up for the program, payments that they've already made, they're given retroactive credit for. But we aren't able to properly project, in part because we don't have sort of years and years of data to build on yet.
Certainly. It's your chair.
Okay. Any other questions? I just have one little question dealing with the annual notification. Mm-hmm. I'm always a little cautious of mandates we put on, you know, businesses.
And I'm wondering if there's a different way that that could be done, where an employer gets notified. I know some probably have an employee manual of some kind, but that could be part of that document. So, you know, it's not a big deal, but I just, you know, it's something that has to be repeated. I would think that in most cases, if you're notified once, that's your responsibility to act if you want to. You don't have to be reminded every year. I don't know if there's a way to not do it the way you're listing it in the bill, but that's the only part that I thought maybe some might find it just one more little aggravation that, you know, the state is required.
Any response? Yeah, Mr. Chair, to your question, I would just note, so we did meet with representatives of the school districts, the counties, and the cities, and they did say that they're neutral on the bill. Essentially, they don't have concerns about the way that it's structured, and given that they are explicitly allowed to email the information rather than having to print and physically distribute it, they don't have concerns. You'll also hear from Ms. Ray in a moment, who represents the nonprofit community, and they're here in favor of the bill.
It's probably not a major thing. It's good to hear that. Any questions of this testifier, or otherwise we'll move on to the next one? Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Can I just introduce yourself?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Anna. I'm back again. hopefully you remember me.
I'll say your last name for the record.
I'm Anna Regett. Sorry about that. So I'm here again to testify to the bill on House 2576 to promote the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. I chose to make this comment on this bill because of the mass student loan debt and how huge of a problem it is for our future educators. And I think that this bill will help as well. So my peers and future educators have firsthand experience with the crippling loan debt we have been talking about today. The University of Minnesota requires an extra graduate year on top of our undergrad program, and doing so racks up loans for both undergraduate tuition and graduate tuition in 5 to 6 years. This is not unusual, however, because many universities and programs across the state require students 5 or more years to complete the program. But specifically, at the University of Minnesota, the average debt load for graduating just undergraduates is around $27,578, given that's just for undergraduate tuition, not counting graduate tuition or any other additional schooling you may need. So this means that you will need an annual salary of at least $55,156 to afford to repay your debt and cover your average living expenses. That means that your future teachers will be close to the same amount of debt as their entire first-year salary. I have seen debt affect our personal recruitment and retention for the profession, as people are no longer interested in a job that will not promise them the ability to pay their debt and finance living situations at the same time. And I have had many pre-service teachers and first-year teachers in the service express concerns to me about their future. They are concerned about their ability to pay off their enormous loans and that are needed in order for them to be a well-prepared and licensed teacher, because simply not going to school and not being licensed does not allow them to be the teacher they want to be. I am concerned with the fact that many of them do not know about loan forgiveness programs that are available for them until it is far too late. And I'm asking the committee to not wait until it's too late for our educators. We need help with finding the information about our loan forgiveness options right away within our teacher preparation programs at the university or within their first years of teaching in schools. This alone would be a big help and a huge relief for us going into the profession. In addition, it will help with our recruitment and retention of teachers as people become more aware of the options earlier on. Finally, I just want to thank you for hearing my testimonies today and listening to what I have collected as concerns from future educators.
Thank you for being here. Staying here.
We have one more, Mr. Chair.
More mm-hmm. You have one that was not able to stay.
That is right.
Welcome, and state your name, please, for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the Higher Ed and Policy and Finance Committee, my name is Renal Ray. I represent the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. I just wanted to thank you for saving the best bill for last today after a long hearing. MCN is a statewide association of over 2,100 nonprofit organizations with offices in St. Paul, Mankato, Duluth, Bemidji, Moorhead, Rochester, and St. Cloud. I'm here to express MCN's support for Representative Murphy's bill, House File 2576, that promotes federal loan forgiveness programs. As public service organizations, Minnesota's nonprofit sector makes up about 12% of the state's workforce and plays an important role in Minnesota's communities, providing vital services, employing local residents, and improving the quality of life. Among other things, nonprofit employees work on the front lines of human service organizations, help develop our state's youth, create, produce, and promote art and culture, provide critical legal services, and preserve our environment for years to come. Average wages in the nonprofit sector are below those in business and government, and nonetheless, nonprofits remain attractive employers. Promoting the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program will help nonprofits statewide recruit talented people and new graduates committed and passionate about serving their communities. And while some eligible nonprofit employees avail themselves of federal public service loan forgiveness, many do not, and managers don't know about the program or its requirements, and we think that there is a need for more widespread promotion and notice of the existing opportunity. Promoting public service loan forgiveness will help alleviate student loan debt burden and can make employment in public service more sustainable. Further, it's an important administratively feasible opportunity as far as employment mandates go for nonprofit employers to retain quality staff. The Minnesota Council of Nonprofits urges your consideration of this bill, and thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Well, we did a good job.
We always do.
Makes my job easy. Any other thing? That's the last of your test times?
It is, Mr. Chair.
I should ask if anyone else in the audience wants to come forward, but they've already tried to follow. Any other discussions on the bill? It seems pretty straightforward.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm really grateful that you're giving the bill a hearing. I hope that you consider it favorably when you put your bill together. We can help our people with this. Okay. And with that, I'd ask for your vote.
Thank you for bringing it to us. House File 2576, as amended, then will be laid over classical inclusion. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, members, for coming back. Now